I'm George Liston, CA. James T. Farrell is best known for his Studs Lonergan trilogy, a classic of 20th century American literature. But Farrell's life itself was something of a major American narrative, encompassing, as it did, most of the significant literary, political, and social cross-currents of his time. His output was prolific, but it was matched in full by the almost manic energy of his mind and the passion of his convictions. By the time of his death, Farrell had assured his place in literature and left his mark on the intellectual history of the country. My guest today is Robert Landers, author of An Honest Writer, The Life and Times of James T. Farrell. Bob Landers, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George.
We'll talk about that place of his in American literature, Bob, which is, I think, one of the key topics when we think of James T. Farrell. And when we do think of him, as I said in the introduction, Bob, I'm sure that practically everyone thinks Studs Lonergan almost immediately. And this book is, I think, faithfully described as a brutally honest, fictionalized retelling of the rough-and-tumble life of Chicago's Southside Irish in the early part of the 20th century. And he would use these themes, the themes of this book and many of these characters many, many times in other things he wrote. But I guess the first question is this, Bob Landers. What's your sense of his real feeling toward them? I mean, did he, when you think of the community, the culture, and the church and all it represented, did he like it? Did he repudiate it? What was his sense of it all?
Well, I think his feelings changed over time. I think as a young man, he rebelled against the values of his family, his community, and felt very estranged from that community. In his maturity, as he grew older, he I think by the end of his life, he had a very different view of things.
Right.
As a young man, he thought he had received a terrible education in the parochial schools, and as an older man, he saw that he had learned quite a lot, actually.
Yeah. You know, there's a very touching, actually, moment toward the latter part of your book where he returns to Chicago, and it really is kind of a sentimental journey. I mean, he seems to be at peace with, if not the church itself, at least certain of the priests and
yeah, he became friends with the priests who were the teachers and functionaries, I guess you could say, at his old school.
Mm-hmm.
And he would stay with them on visits to Chicago, and he would sit up talking with them, and he would write them letters and send them his books.
Right.
And I think he, although he remained an atheist, he obviously had a good deal of feeling about the church.
When you use verbs like talking and writing, people listening should understand this man did an extraordinary amount of both of those things. He was quite prolix and prolific.
He was a compulsive writer. When he began writing, he didn't really begin, aside from schoolboy writings, until he was at the University of Chicago, and he came under the influence of a professor there named James Weber Lynn,
mm-hmm.
who was an English professor, who encouraged them, his students, to write and promised to read it all. And Farrell took him at his word. And
right.
He was working at a gas station, and he would be standing there with his hands greasy and writing on all sorts of cheap paper that he found around, and he just wrote and wrote and wrote, and
yeah.
His handwriting was extremely hard to read.
Right.
It remained so throughout his life.
Mm-hmm.
But Lynn read it all.
Chicago was fundamental to him, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. One of his editors at Vanguard Press said that the life seemed to depart from his fiction when he left Chicago,
mm-hmm.
when his fiction left Chicago, I should say. In a sense, he was in exile. some writers seem to need to be in exile to write about that.
People will be perhaps not surprised, but I would think delighted to know there was a real Studs behind all this, or at least a person, a Studs Cunningham, actually.
Right.
Tell us a bit about Studs Cunningham and his effect on Farrell, both as an inspiration and then probably later as a presence in his life.
Well, he was, his name was William Cunningham. His parents were what they called lace curtain Irish, fairly well off. His father was a plastering contractor. And Farrell first met him in May 1915, May 1st. Farrell and his grandmother and uncle and aunt had just moved into the Washington Park area. And one of the first kids he met was Cunningham. Cunningham mm-hmm. was, Farrell then was 11, and Cunningham was nearly 13. But although he was less than 2 years older, he was three grades ahead. Because evidently he had started school earlier.
One gets a sense of a kind of a cocky, commanding presence, or is that right?
I think that's right. And he later in life, he was dead by then, but in later decades, people who knew him would compare him with Jimmy Cagney.
Right.
Say he looked just like him. And that kind of strutting, swaggering, he was kind of a would-be tough. He was one of the best fighters in the immediate vicinity. But, he wasn't as tough as he pretended to be.
He died at 26, didn't he? Some thereabouts?
Yeah, he died in 1929 from double pneumonia. Mm-hmm. And Farrell went to his wake. Farrell, for a time, I should say, looked up to Cunningham. Not surprisingly, perhaps, because his father feared that his uncle, with whom Farrell was living, was turning him into what he called a dude, a sissy. And perhaps aware of some of these concerns, Farrell naturally looked up to this seeming tough guy for a while. And he didn't really have, he was never close friends with him. I don't think he'd ever, rarely been to his house. But he saw him now and then.
Right.
And at any rate, when Cunningham died, Farrell went to the wake. And he was moved, by that time he was in the University of Chicago, he was writing, and he was moved to write a short story called Studs. In it, he stuck pretty close to the facts, closer than he did in the subsequent novels. But that led him to write the novels.
Let me take a moment from our conversation, Bob, just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Robert Landers, author of An Honest Writer, The Life and Times of James T. Farrell. The Times of James T. Farrell. And we can't even talk about them without talking about the women in his life who kind of mark those times. And we could devote the entire conversation to this aspect of his life, but let me put them all together in a paragraph and see if I can ask a question out of it. First of all, there's Dorothy Butler, who he actually weds twice, quite a character herself, and the whole story of the two marriages is worth the price of the book. Then there's Hortense Alden, who one of his later loves said was the love of his life, a very beautiful actress, but a very, very difficult personality, Hortense Alden. And then there's Cleo Parturas with him at the end, called by someone else the ministering angel, who stood by him in the latter years of his life and was with him at his death. All of these women, and many more, quite frankly, besides, seem to mirror different aspects of him and to respond to different needs. I mean, I got a sense of this multifaceted person with this group of very important people in his own life. What's your sense of his romantic relationships, all told?
Well, it's difficult to sum them up. I think one of the things that struck me was that he did not himself seem to have a strong sense of fidelity, of obligation on his part. Marriage, of course, during his Marxist phase, marriage was a bourgeois institution, and so on and so forth. But however he construed it over time, he never seems to have had even for all the work I've done, I'm still an outsider to all this, and I don't pretend to be necessarily the last word on these things. But it does seem to me that he did not have a strong sense of fidelity. Mm-hmm. Certainly that's evident with Dorothy. Even after they had become lovers at the university there, he still was at least fleetingly unfaithful. And then, of course, he left her finally for Hortense. And I think he really came to have a kind of Dewey-esque view of things, of change, of sort of this endless flowing of change.
Right.
And
right.
You could see that in a letter he wrote but didn't apparently give to Dorothy when he was trying to explain why he was going to leave her. It was all couched in this Dewey-esque stuff about, you know, change is significant, and it's not good, it's not bad, but we can assimilate it.
Right.
No one's guilty, and
you know, I think there's a lot in what you say. I mean, one is struck by this aspect of his life and the way he managed it, and his lack of fidelity. I think you're right on target. At the same time, one is struck by the strong feelings of loyalty he would get. I mean, Cleopatra, for example, who allied herself with him when she didn't have to, and he was, in his latter years, in very difficult times. I mean, it was, and she accepted the fact that he was going to remain married to Dorothy the second time around, and not get a divorce and so forth. But I mean, that he inspired more loyalty than he gave.
Well, in the case of Cleo, I think he may have ultimately given her his loyalty, and I think in the case of Hortense, he may for a long time. Although, I wouldn't bet any money on it one way or another. But I don't know, have any evidence that he wasn't loyal to her. I think you can see from his letters to her that he did have very romantic feelings, pet names back and forth, and mm-hmm. so on and so forth, and about her. I wouldn't try to say who was the love of his life, but I think there is some plausibility to the view that she was. Mm-hmm. But of course, Dorothy was such an important figure in his life, she is still alive today, and although I understand in poor health, but I don't know. I would want to tread softly in trying to sum up his romantic life.
But. Well, one probably should tread softly, and yet they're fascinating chapters, these relationships. Equally fascinating chapters of his life are his political leanings and relationships. And this is a revelation, I think, for the 21st century reader, that there was a time when, not that long ago, when in our national intellectual life, being a writer was more than just putting words on paper. Very often it was taking a political stand at some risk, and this is something he never shied away from. He was, I think it's fair to say, a man of the left throughout his life. But he did something, and although much can be said about it, time constrains us to just one or two things to explore. And what fascinates me most, Bob, was his prescience, if I can use that word. As a man of the left, he sort of early committed himself to the communist philosophy, but then was one of the first to decide that Stalin was a villain and to divorce himself from it. Were you struck by that as well?
Well, he was in 1936 with the first Moscow show trial. He perceived that it was a sham and decided to speak out about it. Mm-hmm. And so he broke with the party. He remained a lowercase communist for some time and was sympathetic to Trotsky and went to the
Mexico
to Mexico for the Dewey Commission's hearings that they conducted with Trotsky in the dock, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And they found him not guilty, not surprisingly, but and then, of course, with particularly after the Hitler-Stalin Pact, a lot of people saw that there was something amiss there in Moscow.
But the fact that he saw it so early, though, was pretty costly to him. For example, a lot of the feuds of the writers and the literary critics and the authors they chose to attack are quite vitriolic at this time. And there's I think he himself felt that many times he was being picked on, his books criticized, because he was an apostate in terms of Stalinism.
That's true. And there was some truth to the idea. The communists were enormously influential in the 30s in the literary and academic circles and artistic circles. There's a passage I quote from Philip Robb in 1938. He was a co-founder of Partisan Review, in which he marvels at the marvels in a certain sense at the communist influence and ability to manipulate others in these circles. And there's no question that the fact that he became a renegade in the communist eyes did affect the reception of his books.
Right.
However, it's very hard, if you go back and read the major reviews, it's very hard to determine when someone is, unless it's so blatantly obvious, when someone is honestly expressing their opinion about the defects in his novel, or whether they're affected by their political sympathies. I think it's clear that some were affected.
Right.
But
well, let's talk about that, because as I say, that was a revelation to me how much he had written beyond Studs Lonergan. I mean, there are dozens of novels and books, and but I guess the real question is the overall quality of all that work. What would you say about it? And here we are really putting a lot in one simple question.
Well, I think he wrote more than 50 published books. I never bothered to actually count, because it's pretty arbitrary. Do you count Studs Lonergan, which is a trilogy? Do you count it as three books or one book or four books? I think his reputation went into decline, but his political opposition to the communists was only part of the explanation. Another part was the turn away from naturalism, particularly after the World War II. And another part was Farrell himself. He wrote some novels which were pretty awful, the Bernard Clare series in particular. And I think some of the best novels, I think, aside from the Lonergan trilogy, are in the what used to be called the Danny O'Neill or the O'Neill O'Flaherty series of novels.
Danny O'Neill was his alter ego.
Right. Yeah. These were very autobiographical, as Lonergan was only partly autobiographical.
Would you say, Bob, that the farther he got away from himself and the farther he got away from Chicago, the riskier his writing got, I mean, the less successful it got?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think the O'Neill series was really remarkable, and I was perhaps particularly interested in it because, as its biographer, because I it is autobiographical, mm-hmm. so it gave me insights and what questions to ask and so on and so forth. But I think they are remarkable books, remarkable novels, and that the way they convey, and the characters are very vivid in them, and that he's able, because of his memory, to reproduce that era in time,
right,
in the early part of the 20th century in Chicago in just a fantastic way. So I think those that series of novels, it has its weaknesses, and it's kind of a ragged masterpiece, but I wish that literary critics would take it up, as some have, but I wish more would do so, and, mm-hmm. and really consider whether it isn't a masterpiece. However, the great run of his novels, I think, and particularly his short stories, I find mm-hmm. not too compelling. There are exceptions. Mm-hmm. I think his general problem was that he was not a stylist.
Yeah, someone says, for example, someone, I think a woman, I can't remember her, which.
I think you're thinking of Luna Wolf, his secretary's comment.
She says he's a writer or an author rather than a stylist, she called him.
Yeah, he was, Luna Wolf, who was his part-time secretary and also, to some extent, an editor mm-hmm. of his, told me that he was a writer in a way who couldn't write. This sounds more dismissive than she meant it, or than I would certainly mean it. He just couldn't polish his prose.
Right.
When he was writing about his childhood and about the youth in Chicago, and he was really good, but eventually, you know, the well ran dry. I mean, he tried to write about more adult situations mm-hmm. in New York and the radicals and so on and so forth, and it just wasn't as successful. I think a common criticism of one of those Bernard Clare or Bernard Carr, as he came to be called, books was there was too much of the self, the rebellious self there, and not enough of the mm-hmm. world against which he was rebelling.
Right. Well, you know, I have to say, Bob, as we come to the conclusion of this conversation, that, like the title of the book, An Honest Writer, this has been a very honest conversation, because I think you've balanced very nicely the great strengths against some of the weaknesses of this author. And you've already encouraged us, and I think all listening as well as critics, to go back and reread the masterpieces, the books you think are his most important output. And that suggests, as we conclude, this obvious question. If we all do that, where do you, Bob Landers, think we would end up placing him in the pantheon of 20th century American writers? What do you think would be an honest verdict, put it that way?
Well, I frankly am not sure. I don't think I think he wrote some great books, although the term great is thrown around so much that so I would prefer to say he wrote some books which people ought to read. And I think, you know, you read like the books in the O'Neill series, and those characters in there, which are based on his family for the most part, are alive and in a way that the characters in a Hemingway novel are not really alive. Hemingway was a much better stylist, of course, and but Farrell had definite strengths, and one was in creating those characters, and another was in the close correspondence between the real world as it was affecting millions of Irish immigrants and their progeny, and in the fictional world that he created in such incredible detail. So I'm not sure where the where he would stand in the pantheon. I'm not even sure it matters that much. I just think people should read these mm-hmm. books and make a judgment and not leave him in the neglect which he's been in for so long.
Well, that's an honest verdict. I think that and what it reminds us of is that, you know, maybe the question isn't is someone great or not, is as for a writer, the question is he or she worth reading? And I guess you say this man's worth reading.
I think he is. There was another point which, if you have time, which I thought was interesting. I think he was in thrall to the romantic conception of the writer, that as many people are, the idea that the writer, the great writer, is a genius who everything he touches has merit and should be scrutinized closely for clues to the great secret of creation and so on and so forth. And I guess this provides employment to a lot of English professors and so on. But I wish he had stopped writing at a certain point or somehow and in some impossible way done something which he might have enjoyed more. I think he would have enjoyed it. He was a tremendous baseball fan. If he could mm-hmm. have just covered a team for a season, mm-hmm. you know, as a baseball writer, I think he would have really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. If he could have gotten away from the idea that he was a great novelist and should be mm-hmm. writing these novels instead. but that's just impossible. And, you know, you can say how people should have lived their lives, but I think he lived an interesting life.
That's part of the fun of living life, saying how people should live it. But anyway, this is a fascinating life and a fascinating book, and thank you so much for it.
No, thank you, George. Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Robert Landers, author of An Honest Writer, The Life and Times of James T. Farrell. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. Our associate producer is Rachel Edmonds. And our assistant producer is Sharona Ward. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.